Dominique left for Reno early in the morning. Keating was still asleep, and she did not awaken him to say goodbye. When he opened his eyes, he knew that she was gone before he looked at the clock, by the quality of the silence in the house. He thought he should say good riddance, but he did not say it, and he did not feel it. What he felt was a vast, flat sentence without subject. It's no use. Related neither to himself nor to Dominique. He was alone, and there was no necessity to pretend anything. He lay in bed on his back, his arms flung out helplessly. His face looked humble, and his eyes bewildered. He felt that it was an end, and a death. But he did not mean the loss of Dominique. He got up and dressed. In the bathroom, he found a hand towel she had used and discarded. He picked it up, he pressed his face to it, and held it for a long time. Not in sorrow, but in nameless emotion. Not understanding, knowing only that he had loved her twice, on that evening when Tui telephoned. And now. Then he opened his fingers and let the towel slip down to the floor, like a liquid running between his fingers. He went to his office and worked as usual. Nobody knew of his divorce, and he felt no desire to inform anyone. Neil Dumont winked at him and drawled, "I say, Pete, you look peaked." He shrugged and turned his back. The sight of Dumont made him sick today. He left the office early. A vague instinct kept pulling at him, like hunger at first, then taking shape. He had to see Ellsworth Tui. He had to reach Tui. He felt like the survivor of a shipwreck swimming toward a distant light. That evening he dragged himself to Ellsworth Tui's apartment. When he entered, he felt dimly glad of his self-control, because Tui seemed to notice nothing in his face.
"Oh, hello, Peter," said Tui airily. "Your sense of timing leaves much to be desired. You catch me on the worst possible evening, busy as all hell. But don't let that bother you. What are friends for but to inconvenience one? Sit down, sit down. I'll be with you in a minute."
"I'm sorry, Ellsworth, but I had to."
"Make yourself at home. Just ignore me for a minute, will you?"
Keating sat down and waited. Tui worked, making notes on sheets of typewritten copy. He sharpened a pencil, the sound grating like a saw across Keating's nerves. He bent over his copy again, rustling the pages once in a while. Half an hour later, he pushed the papers aside and smiled at Keating.
"That's that," he said.
Keating made a small movement forward.
"Sit tight," said Tui. "Just one telephone call I've got to make."
He dialed the number of Gus Webb.
"Hello, Gus," he said gaily. "How are you, you walking advertisement for contraceptives?"
Keating had never heard that tone of loose intimacy from Tui, a special tone of brotherhood that permitted sloppiness. He heard Webb's piercing voice say something and laugh in the receiver. The receiver went on spitting out rapid sounds from deep down in its tube, like a throat being cleared. The words could not be recognized, only their quality, the quality of abandon and insolence, with high shrieks of mirth once in a while. Tui leaned back in his chair, listening, half smiling.
"Yes," he said occasionally. "Uh-huh. You said it, boy. Sure it in hell."
He leaned back farther and put one foot in a shining, pointed shoe on the edge of the desk.
"Listen, boy, what I wanted to tell you is go easy on old Bassett for a while. Sure he liked your work, but don't shock hell out of him for the time being. No roughhouse, see? Keep that big facial cavity of yours buttoned up. You know damn well who I am to tell you." "That's right. That's the stuff, kid." "Oh, he did. Good angel face. Well, bye-bye. Oh, say, Gus, have you heard the one about the British lady and the plumber?"
There followed a story. The receiver yelled raucously at the end.
"Well, watch your step and your digestion, angel face. Nighty-night."
Tui dropped the receiver, said,
"Now, Peter."
Stretched, got up, walked to Keating and stood before him, rocking a little on his small feet, his eyes bright and kindly.
"Now, Peter, what's the matter? Has the world crashed about your nose?"
Keating reached into his inside pocket and produced a yellow check, crumpled, much handled. It bore his signature and the sum of $10,000 made out to Ellsworth M. Toohey. The gesture with which he handed it to Toohey was not that of a donor, but of a beggar. "Please, Ellsworth. Here. Take this. For a good cause. For the workshop of social study, or for anything you wish. You know best. For a good cause." Toohey held the check with the tips of his fingers like a soiled penny, bent his head to one side, pursing his lips in appreciation, and tossed the check on his desk.
"Very handsome of you, Peter. Very handsome indeed. What's the occasion?"
"Ellsworth, you remember what you said once, that it doesn't matter what we are or do if we help others. That's all that counts. That's good, isn't it? That's clean."
"I haven't said it once. I've said it a million times."
"And it's really true?"
"Of course it's true, if you have the courage to accept it."
"You're my friend, aren't you? You're the only friend I've got. I'm not even friendly with myself, but you are. With me, I mean, aren't you, Ellsworth?"
"But of course. Which is of more value than your own friendship with yourself? A rather queer conception, but quite valid."
"You understand. Nobody else does. And you like me."
"Devotedly. Whenever I have the time."
Your
sense of humor, Peter, where's your sense of humor? What's the matter, a bellyache? Or a soul indigestion?
Ellsworth?
Yes.
I can't tell you. Even you.
You're a coward, Peter.
Keating stared helplessly. The voice had been severe and gentle. He did not know whether he should feel pain, insult, or confidence.
"You come here to tell me that it doesn't matter what you do, and then you go to pieces over something or other you've done. Come on, be a man and say it doesn't matter. Say you're not important. Mean it. Show some guts. Forget your little ego."
"I'm not important, Ellsworth. I'm not important.
Oh, God, if only everybody'd say it like you do.
I'm not important. I don't want to be important."
"Where did that money come from?"
"I sold Dominique."
"What are you talking about? The cruise?"
"Only it seems as if it's not Dominique that I sold."
"What do you care if—"
"She's gone to Reno."
"What?"
He could not understand the violence of Toohey's reaction, but he was too tired to wonder. He told everything, as it had happened to him. It had not taken long to happen, or to tell.
"You damn fool! You shouldn't have allowed it."
"What could I do? Against Wynand?"
"But to let him marry her."
"Why not, Ellsworth? It's better than—"
"I didn't think he'd ever—" "But—" "Oh, God. Damn it, I'm a bigger fool than you are."
"But it's better for Dominique if—"
"To hell with your Dominique. It's Wynand I'm thinking about."
"Ellsworth, what's the matter with you? Why should you care?"
"Keep still, will you? Let me think."
In a moment, Toohey shrugged, sat down beside Keating, and slipped his arm about his shoulders.
"I'm sorry, Peter," he said. "I apologize. I've been inexcusably rude to you. It was just the shock. But I understand how you feel. Only you mustn't take it too seriously. It doesn't matter."
He spoke automatically. His mind was far away. Keating did not notice that. He heard the words. They were spring in the desert.
"It doesn't matter. You're only human. That's all you want to be. Who's any better? Who has the right to cast the first stone? We're all human. It doesn't matter."
"My God," said Alva Scarrett. "He can't. Not Dominique Francon."
"He will," said Toohey, "as soon as she returns."
Scarrett had been surprised that Toohey should invite him to lunch, but the news he heard wiped out the surprise in a greater and more painful one.
"I'm fond of Dominique," said Scarrett, pushing his plate aside, his appetite gone. "I've always been very fond of her. But to have her as Mrs. Gale Wynand—"
"These, exactly, are my own sentiments," said Toohey.
"I've always advised him to marry. It helps, lends an air. an insurance of respectability, sort of, and he could do with one. He's always skated on pretty thin ice, got away with it so far. But Dominique?
Why do you find such a marriage unsuitable?
Well, it's not.
Damn it, you know it's not right.
I know it. Do you?
Look, she's a dangerous kind of woman.
She is. That's your minor premise. Your major premise, however, is he's a dangerous kind of man.
Well, in some ways.
Yes. My esteemed editor, you understand me quite well. But there are times when it's helpful to formulate things. It tends toward future cooperation. You and I have a great deal in common, though you have been somewhat reluctant to admit it. We are two variations on the same theme, shall we say. Or we play two ends against the same middle, if you prefer your own literary style. But our dear boss is quite another tune, a different leitmotif entirely. Don't you think so, Alva? Our dear boss is an accident in our midst. Accidents are unreliable phenomena. You've been sitting on the edge of your seat for years, haven't you? Watching Mr. Gale Winand, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know also that Miss Dominique Francone is not our tune either, and you do not wish to see that particular influence enter the life of our boss. Do I have to state the issue any plainer?
You're a smart man, Ellsworth, said Skerritt heavily.
That's been obvious for years.
I'll talk to him.
You'd better not. He hates your guts, if you'll excuse me. But I don't think I'd do much good either. Not if he's made up his mind. I don't expect you to. You may try if you wish, though it's useless. We can't stop that marriage. One of my good points is the fact that I admit defeat when it has to be admitted.
But then, why did you
tell you this?
In the nature of a scoop, Alva.
Advance information.
I appreciate it, Ellsworth. I sure do.
It would be wise to go on appreciating it. The Winand papers, Alva, are not to be given up easily. In unity, there is strength. Your style.
What do you mean?
Only that we're in for a difficult time, my friend. So we'd do better to stick together.
Why, I'm with you, Ellsworth.
I've always been. Inaccurate, but we'll let it pass. We're concerned only with the present. And the future. As a token of mutual understanding, how about getting rid of Jimmy Kearns at the first opportunity?
I thought you've been driving at that for months. What's the matter with Jimmy Kearns? He's a bright kid, the best drama critic in town. He's got a mind, smart as a whip, most promising.
He's got a mind. Of his own. I don't think you want any whips around the place, except the one you hold. I think you want to be careful about what the promise promises.
Whom'll I stick in his spot?
Jules Fogler.
Oh, hell, Ellsworth.
Why not?
That old son of a... We can't afford him.
You can if you want to. And look at the name he's got.
But he's the most impossible old...
Well, you don't have to take him. We'll discuss it some other time. Just get rid of Jimmy Kearns.
Look, Ellsworth, I don't play favorites. It's all the same to me. I'll give Jimmy the boot if you say so.
Only I don't see what difference it makes, and what it's got to do with what we were talking about. You don't, said Tui. You will.
Gale, you know that I want you to be happy, said Alva Skerritt, sitting in a comfortable armchair in the study of Winand's penthouse that evening. You know that. I'm thinking of nothing else.
Winand lay stretched out on a couch, one leg bent, with the foot resting on the knee of the other. He smoked and listened carefully.
I've known Dominique for years, said Skerritt. Long before you even heard of her.
I love her. I love her, you might say, like a father.
But you've got to admit that she's not the kind of woman your public would expect to see as Mrs. Gale Winand.
Winand said nothing.
Your wife is a public figure, Gale. Just automatically, a public property. Your readers have a right to demand and expect certain things of her. A symbol value, if you know what I mean, like the Queen of England, sort of. How do you expect Dominique to live up to that? How do you expect her to preserve any appearances at all? She's the wildest person I know. She has a terrible reputation. But worst of all, think, Gale, a divorcee. And here we spend tons of good print standing for the sanctity of the home and the purity of womanhood. How are you going to make your public swallow that one? How am I going to sell your wife to them?
Don't you think this conversation had better be stopped, Alva?
Yes, Gale, said Scarrett meekly.
Scarrett waited, with a heavy sense of aftermath, as if after a violent quarrel, anxious to make up.
I know, Gale, he cried happily. I know what we can do. We'll put Dominic back on the paper, and we'll have her write a column, a different one, a syndicated column on the home. You know, household hints, kitchens, babies, and all that. It'll take the curse off. Show what a good little homebody she really is, her youthful mistakes notwithstanding. Make the women forgive her. We'll have a special department. Mrs. Gale Winans, recipes. A few pictures of her will help. You know, gingham dresses and aprons and her hair done up in a more conventional way.
Shut up, Alva, before I slap your face, said Winans, without raising his voice.
Yes, Gale.
Scarrett made a move to get up. Sit still. I haven't finished. Scarrett waited obediently. Tomorrow morning, said Winans, you will send a memo to every one of our papers. You will tell them to look through their files and find any pictures of Dominique Francone they might have in connection with her old column. You will tell them to destroy the pictures. You will tell them that henceforward any mention of her name or the use of her picture in any of my papers will cost the job of the entire editorial staff responsible. When the proper time comes, you will have an announcement of my marriage appear in all our papers. That cannot be avoided. The briefest announcement you can compose. No commentaries, no stories, no pictures. Pass the word around and make sure it's understood. It's any man's job, yours included, if this is disobeyed.
No stories? When you marry her?
No stories, Alva.
But, good God, that's news!
The other papers? I don't care what the other papers do about it.
But why, Gale?
You wouldn't understand. Dominique sat at the window listening to the train wheels under the floor. She looked at the countryside of Ohio flying past in the fading daylight. Her head lay back against the seat, and her hands lay limply at each side of her on the seat cushion. She was one with the structure of the car. She was carried forward just as the window frame, the floor, the walls of the compartment were carried forward. The corners blurred, gathering darkness. The window remained luminous, evening light rising from the earth. She let herself rest in that faint illumination. It entered the car and ruled it, so long as she did not turn on the light to shut it out. She had no consciousness of purpose. There was no goal to this journey, only the journey itself, only the motion and the metal sound of motion around her. She felt slack and empty, losing her identity in a painless ebb, content to vanish, and let nothing remain defined, save that particular earth in the window. When she saw, in the slowing movement beyond the glass, the name Clayton on a faded board under the eaves of a station building, she knew what she had been expecting. She knew why she had taken this train, not a faster one. Why she had looked carefully at the timetable of its stops, though it had been just a column of meaningless names to her then. She seized her suitcase, coat, and hat. She ran. She could not take time to dress, afraid that the floor under her feet would carry her away from here. She ran down the narrow corridor of the car, down the steps. She leaped to the station platform, feeling the shock of winter cold on her bare throat. She stood looking at the station building. She heard the train moving behind her, clattering away. Then she put on her coat and hat. She walked across the platform into the waiting room, across a wooden floor studded with lumps of dry chewing gum, through the heavy billows of heat from an iron stove, to the square beyond the station. She saw a last band of yellow in the sky above the low roof lines. She saw a pitted stretch of paving bricks and small houses leaning against one another, a bare tree with twisted branches, skeletons of weeds at the doorless opening of an abandoned garage, dark shop fronts, a drugstore still open on a corner, its lighted window dim, low over the ground. She had never been here before, but she felt this place proclaiming its ownership of her, closing in about her with ominous intimacy. It was as if every dark mass exercised a suction, like the pull of the planets in space, prescribing her orbit. She put her hand on a fire hydrant and felt the cold seeping through her glove into her skin. This was the way the town held her, a direct penetration which neither her clothes nor her mind could stop. The peace of the inevitable remained. Only now she had to act, but the actions were simple, set in advance. She asked a passerby, "Where is the site of the new building of Chainer's department store?" She walked patiently through the dark streets. She walked past desolate winter lawns and sagging porches, past vacant lots where weeds rustled against tin cans, past closed grocery stores and a steaming laundry, past an uncurtained window where a man in shirt sleeves sat by a fire reading a paper. She turned corners and crossed streets, with the feel of cobblestones under the thin soles of her pumps. Rare passers-by looked, astonished, at her air of foreign elegance. She noticed it. She felt an answering wonder. She wanted to say, "But don't you understand? I belong here more than you do." She stopped once in a while, closing her eyes. She found it difficult to breathe. She came to Main Street and walked slower. There were a few lights, cars parked diagonally at the curb, a movie theater, a store window displaying pink underwear among kitchen utensils. She walked stiffly, looking ahead. She saw a glare of light on the side of an old building, on a blind wall of yellow bricks showing the sooted floor lines of a neighboring structure that had been torn down. The light came from an excavation pit. She knew this was the site. She hoped it was not. If they worked late, he would be here. She did not want to see him tonight. She had wanted only to see the place and the building. She was not ready for more. She had wanted to see him tomorrow. But she could not stop now. She walked to the excavation. It lay on a corner, open to the street, without fence. She heard the grinding clatter of iron. She saw the arm of a derrick, the shadows of men on the slanting sides of fresh earth, yellow in the light. She could not see the planks that led up to the sidewalk, but she heard the sound of steps, and then she saw Rourke coming up to the street. He was hatless. He had a loose coat hanging open. He stopped. He looked at her. She thought that she was standing straight, that it was simple and normal. She was seeing the gray eyes and the orange hair as she had always seen them. She was astonished that he moved toward her with a kind of urgent haste, that his hand closed over her elbow too firmly, and he said, "You'd better sit down." Then she knew she could not have stood up without that hand on her elbow. He took her suitcase. He led her across the dark side street and made her sit down on the steps of a vacant house. She leaned back against a closed door. He sat down beside her. He kept his hand tight on her elbow, not a caress, but an impersonal hold of control over both of them. After a while, he dropped his hand. She knew that she was safe now. She could speak.
"That's your new building?"
"Yes." "You walked here from the station?"
"Yes."
"It's a long walk."
"I think it was."
She thought that they had not greeted each other, and that it was right. This was not a reunion, but just one moment out of something that had never been interrupted. She thought how strange it would be if she ever said hello to him. One did not greet oneself each morning.
"What time did you get up today?"
she asked. "At 7.
"I was in New York then, in a cab going to Grand Central." "Where did you have breakfast?"
"In a lunch wagon."
"The kind that stays open all night?"
"Yes, mostly for truck drivers."
"Do you go there often?"
"Whenever I want a cup of coffee."
"And you sit at a counter? And there are people around looking at you?"
"I sit at a counter when I have the time. There are people around. I don't think they look at me much."
"And afterward? You walk to work?"
"Yes."
"You walk every day? Down any of these streets? Past any window? So that if one just wanted to reach and open the window..."
"People don't stare out of windows here." From the vantage of the high stoop, they could see the excavation across the street, the earth, the workmen, the rising steel columns in a glare of harsh light. She thought it was strange to see fresh earth in the midst of pavements and cobblestones, as if a piece had been torn from the clothing of a town, showing naked flesh.
She said, "You've done 2 country homes in the last 2 years."
"Yes, one in Pennsylvania and one near Boston."
"They were unimportant houses."
Inexpensive, if that's what you mean. But very interesting to do.
How long will you remain here?
Another month.
Why do you work at night?
It's a rush job.
Across the street, the derrick was moving, balancing a long girder in the air. She saw him watching it, and she knew he was not thinking of it. But there was the instinctive response in his eyes, something physically personal. Intimacy with any action taken for his building. Rourke.
They had not pronounced each other's names. It had the sensuous pleasure of a surrender long delayed, to pronounce the name and to have him hear it.
Rourke. It's the quarry again.
He smiled. If you wish. Only it isn't.
After the Enright House? After the Cord building?
I don't think of it that way.
How do you think of it?
I love doing it. Every building is like a person, single and unrepeatable.
He was looking across the street. He had not changed. There was the old sense of lightness in him, of ease in motion, in action, in thought. She said, her sentence without beginning or end. Doing 5-story buildings for the rest of your life.
If necessary. But I don't think it will be like that.
What are you waiting for?
I'm not waiting. She closed her eyes, but she could not hide her mouth. Her mouth held bitterness, anger, and pain.
Rourke, if you'd been in the city, I wouldn't have come to see you.
I know it.
But it was you, in another place, in some nameless hole of a place like this. I had to see it. I had to see the place.
When are you going back?
You know I haven't come to remain?
Yes.
Why?
You're still afraid of lunch wagons and windows.
I'm not going back to New York, not at once.
No.
You haven't asked me anything, Rourke, only whether I walked from the station.
What do you want me to ask you?
I got off the train when I saw the name of the station, she said, her voice dull. I didn't intend coming here. I was on my way to Reno.
And after that?
I will marry again.
Do I know your fiancé?
You've heard of him. His name is Gale Winant.
She saw his eyes. She thought she should want to laugh. She had brought him at last to a shock she had never expected to achieve. But she did not laugh. He thought of Henry Cameron. Of Cameron saying,
I have no answer to give them, Howard. I'm leaving you to face them. You'll answer them, all of them. The Winant papers and what makes the Winant papers possible, and what lies behind that.
Rourke.
He didn't answer.
That's worse than Peter Keating, isn't it? She asked.
Much worse.
Do you want to stop me?
No.
He had not touched her since he had released her elbow, and that had been only a touch proper in an ambulance. She moved her hand and let it rest against his. He did not withdraw his fingers, and he did not pretend indifference. She bent over, holding his hand, not raising it from his knee, and she pressed her lips to his hand. Her hat fell off. He saw the blonde head at his knees. He felt her mouth kissing his hand again and again. His fingers held hers, answering. But that was the only answer. She raised her head and looked at the street. A lighted window hung in the distance behind a grillwork of bare branches. Small houses stretched off into the darkness, and trees stood by the narrow sidewalks. She noticed her hat on the steps below and bent to pick it up. She leaned with her bare hand flat against the steps. The stone was old, worn smooth, icy. She felt comfort in the touch. She sat for a moment, bent over, palm pressed to the stone, to feel these steps, no matter how many feet had used them, to feel them, as she had felt the fire hydrant. Rourke, where do you live?
In a rooming house.
What kind of room?
Just a room.
What's in it? What kind of walls?
Some sort of wallpaper. Faded.
What furniture?
A table, chairs, a bed.
No. Tell me in detail.
There's a clothes closet, then a chest of drawers, the bed in the corner by the window, a large table at the other side.
By the wall?
No, I put it across the corner to the window. I work there. Then there's a straight chair, an armchair with a bridge lamp and a magazine rack I never use. I think that's all.
No rugs? Or curtains?
I think there's something at the window and some kind of rug. The floor is nicely polished. It's beautiful old wood.
I want to think of your room tonight. On the train.
He sat looking across the street. She said,
Rourke, let me stay with you tonight.
No. He let her glance follow his to the grinding machinery below. After a while, she asked,
How did you get this store to design?
The owner saw my buildings in New York and liked them. A man in overalls stepped out of the excavation pit, peered into the darkness at them, and called,
Is that you up there, boss?
Yes, Rourke called back.
Come here a minute, will you?
Rourke walked to him across the street. She could not hear their conversation, but she heard Rourke saying gaily, That's easy. And then they both walked down the planks to the bottom. The man stood talking, pointing up, explaining. Rourke threw his head back to glance up at the rising steel frame. The light was full on his face, and she saw his look of concentration, not a smile, but an expression that gave her a joyous feeling of competence, of disciplined reason in action. He bent, picked up a piece of board, took a pencil from his pocket. He stood with one foot on a pile of planks, the board propped on his knee, and drew rapidly, explaining something to the man, who nodded, pleased. She could not hear the words, but she felt the quality of Rourke's relation to that man, to all the other men in that pit, an odd sense of loyalty and of brotherhood, but not the kind she had ever heard named by these words. He finished, handed the board to the man, and they both laughed at something. Then he came back and sat down on the steps beside her.
Rourke, she said, I want to remain here with you for all the years we might have.
He looked at her attentively, waiting.
I want to live here.
Her voice had the sound of pressure against a dam.
I want to live as you live, not to touch my money. I'll give it away to anyone, to Stephen Mallory, if you wish, or to one of Toohey's organizations. It doesn't matter. We'll take a house here, like one of these, and I'll keep it for you. Don't laugh, I can. I'll cook, I'll wash your clothes, I'll scrub the floor. And you'll give up architecture.
He had not laughed. She saw nothing but an unmoving attention, prepared to listen on.
Rourke, try to understand. Please, try to understand. I can't bear to see what they're doing to you, what they're going to do. It's too great. You and building and what you feel about it. You can't go on like that for long. It won't last. They won't let you. You're moving to some terrible kind of disaster. It can't end any other way. Give it up. Take some meaningless job, like the quarry. We'll live here. We'll have little, and we'll give nothing. We'll live only for what we are and for what we know.
He laughed. She heard in the sound of it a surprising touch of consideration for her, the attempt not to laugh. But he couldn't stop it.
Dominique.
The way he pronounced the name remained with her, and made it easier to hear the words that followed.
I wish I could tell you that it was a temptation, at least for a moment. But it wasn't.
He added,
If I were very cruel, I'd accept it, just to see how soon you'd beg me to go back to building.
Yes, probably.
Marry Winant, and stay married to him. It will be better than what you're doing to yourself right now.
Do you mind if we just sit here for a little while longer, and not talk about that? But just talk as if everything were right. Just an armistice for half an hour out of years. Tell me what you've done every day you've been here. Everything you can remember.
Then they talked, as if the stoop of the vacant house were an airplane hanging in space without sight of earth or sky. He did not look across the street. Then he glanced at his wristwatch and said,
There's a train for the West in an hour. Shall I go with you to the station?
Do you mind if we walk there?
All right.
She stood up.
she asked. Until when, Rourke?
His hand moved over the streets.
Until you stop hating all this. Stop being afraid of it. Learn not to notice it.
They walked together to the station. She listened to the sound of his steps with hers in the empty streets. She let her glance drag along the walls they passed like a clinging touch. She loved this place, this town, and everything that was part of it. They were walking past a vacant lot. The wind blew an old sheet of newspaper against her legs. It clung to her with a tight insistence that seemed conscious, like the peremptory caress of a cat. She thought, anything of this town had that intimate right to her. She bent, picked up the paper, and began folding it to keep it.
"What are you doing?" he asked.
"Something to read on the train," she said stupidly. He snatched the paper from her, crumpled it, and flung it away into the weeds. She said nothing, and they walked on. A single light bulb hung over the empty station platform. They waited. He stood looking up at the tracks where the train was to appear. When the tracks rang, shuddering. When the white ball of a headlight spurted out of the distance and stood still in the sky, not approaching, only widening, growing in furious speed. He did not move or turn to her. The rushing beam flung his shadow across the platform, made it sweep over the planks and vanish. For an instant, she saw the tall, straight line of his body against the glare. The engine passed them, and the cars rattled, slowing down. He looked at the windows rolling past. She could not see his face, only the outline of his cheekbone. When the train stopped, he turned to her. They did not shake hands. They did not speak. They stood straight, facing each other for a moment, as if at attention. It was almost like a military salute. Then she picked up her suitcase and went aboard the train. The train started moving a minute later. Chapter 6. Chuck.
And why not a muskrat? Why should man imagine himself superior to a muskrat? Life beats in all the small creatures of field and wood. Life singing of eternal sorrow. An old sorrow. The song of songs. We don't understand, but who cares about understanding? Only public accountants and chiropodists. Also mailmen. We only love. The sweet mystery of love. That's all there is to it. Give me love and shove all your philosophers up your stovepipe. When Mary took the homeless muskrat, her heart broke open and life and love rushed in. Muskrats make good imitation mink coats, but that's not the point. Life is the point. Jake, rushing in. Say, folks, who's got a stamp with a picture of George Washington on it? Curtain.
Ike slammed his manuscript shut and took a long swig of air. His voice was hoarse after 2 hours of reading aloud, and he had read the climax of his play on a single long breath. He looked at his audience, his mouth smiling in self-mockery, his eyebrows raised insolently, but his eyes pleading. Ellsworth Toohey, sitting on the floor, scratched his spine against a chair leg and yawned. Gus Webb, stretched out on his stomach in the middle of the room, rolled over on his back. Lancelot Clokey, the foreign correspondent, reached for his highball glass and finished it off. Jules Fogler, the new drama critic of the Banner, sat without moving. He had not moved for 2 hours. Lois Cook, hostess, raised her arms, twisting them, stretching, and said,
"Jesus, Ike, it's awful."
Lancelot Clokey drawled,
"Lois, my girl, where do you keep your gin? Don't be such a damn miser. You're the worst hostess I know."
Gus Webb said,
"I don't understand literature. It's non-productive and a waste of time. Authors will be liquidated."
Ike laughed shrilly.
"A stinker, huh?"
He waved his script.
"A real super stinker. What do you think I wrote it for? Just show me anyone who can write a bigger flop. Worst play you'll ever hear in your life."
It was not a formal meeting of the Council of American Writers, but an unofficial gathering. Ike had asked a few of his friends to listen to his latest work. At 26 he had written 11 plays, but never had one produced.
"You'd better give up the theater, Ike," said Lancelot Clokey. "Writing is a serious business, and not for any stray bastard that wants to try it."
Lancelot Clokey's first book, an account of his personal adventures in foreign countries, was in its 10th week on the bestseller list.
"Why isn't it, Lance?"
Toohey drawled sweetly.
"All right," snapped Clokey.
All right, give me a drink.
It's awful, said Lois Cook, her head lolling wearily from side to side.
It's perfectly awful. It's so awful, it's wonderful.
Balls, said Gus Webb. Why do I ever come here?
Ike flung his script at the fireplace. It struck against the wire screen and landed face down, open, the thin pages crushed.
If Ibsen can write plays, why can't I?
He asked.
He's good and I'm lousy, but that's not a sufficient reason.
Not in the cosmic sense, said Lancelot Clokey. Still, you're lousy.
You don't have to say it. I said so first.
This is a great play, said a voice.
The voice was slow, nasal, and bored. It had spoken for the first time that evening, and they all turned to Jules Vogler. A cartoonist had once drawn a famous picture of him. It consisted of two sagging circles, a large one and a small one. The large one was his stomach, the small one, his lower lip. He wore a suit, beautifully tailored, of a color to which he referred as mail de doigt. He kept his gloves on at all times, and he carried a cane. He was an eminent drama critic. Jules Vogler stretched out his cane, caught the play script with the hook of the handle, and dragged it across the floor to his feet. He did not pick it up, but he repeated, looking at it,
"This is a great play."
"Why?" asked Lancelot Clokey.
"Because I say so," said Jules Vogler.
"Is that a gag, Jules?" asked Lois Cook.
"I never gag," said Jules Vogler. "It is vulgar."
"Send me a couple of seats to the opening," sneered Lancelot Clokey.
88 for 2 seats to the opening," said Jules Vogler. "It will be the biggest hit of the season."
Jules Vogler turned and saw Tui looking at him. Tui smiled, but the smile was not light or careless. It was an approving commentary upon something he considered as very serious indeed. Vogler's glance was contemptuous when he turned to the others, but it relaxed for a moment of understanding when it rested on Tui.
"Why don't you join the Council of American Writers, Jules?" asked Tui.
"I am an individualist," said Vogler. "I don't believe in organizations. Besides, is it necessary?"
"No, not necessary at all," said Tui cheerfully. "Not for you, Jules. There's nothing I can teach you."
"What I like about you, Ellsworth, is that it's never necessary to explain myself to you."
"Hell, why explain anything here? We're six of a kind."
5, said Vogler. "I don't like Gus Webb."
"Why don't you?"
asked Gus. He was not offended.
"Because he doesn't wash his ears," answered Vogler, as if the question had been asked by a third party.
"Oh, that," said Gus.
Ike had risen and stood staring at Vogler, not quite certain whether he should breathe.
"You like my play, Mr. Vogler?"
he asked at last, his voice small.
"I haven't said I like it,"
Vogler answered coldly.
"I think it smells. That is why it's great."
"Oh,"
said Ike. He laughed. He seemed relieved. His glance went around the faces in the room, a glance of sly triumph.
"Yes," said Vogler. "My approach to its criticism is the same as your approach to its writing. Our motives are identical." "You're a grand guy, Jules." "Mr. Vogler, please." "You're a grand guy and the swellest bastard on earth, Mr. Vogler."
Vogler turned the pages of the script at his feet with the tip of his cane.
"Your typing is atrocious, Ike," he said.
"Hell, I'm not a stenographer. I'm a creative artist."
"You will be able to afford a secretary after this show opens. I shall be obliged to praise it, if for no other reason than to prevent any further abuse of a typewriter such as this. The typewriter is a splendid instrument, not to be outraged."
"All right, Jules," said Lancelot Clokey. "It's all very witty and smart, and you're sophisticated and brilliant as all get-out. But what do you actually want to praise that crap for?"
"Because it is, as you put it, crap."
"You're not logical, Lance," said Ike. "Not in the cosmic sense, you aren't. To write a good play and to have it praised is nothing. Anybody can do that, anybody with talent. And talent is only a glandular accident.
But to write a piece of crap and have it praised? Well, you match that.
He has, said Tui.
That's a matter of opinion, said Lancelot Clokey. He upturned his empty glass over his mouth and sucked at a last piece of ice.
Ike understands things much better than you do, Lance, said Jules Vogler. He has just proved himself to be a real thinker in that little speech of his, which, incidentally, was better than his whole play.
All right, my next play about that, said Ike.
Ike has stated his reasons, Vogler continued, and mine, and also yours, Lance. Examine my case, if you wish. What achievement is there for a critic in praising a good play? None whatever. The critic is then nothing but a kind of glorified messenger boy between author and public. What's there in that for me? I'm sick of it. I have a right to wish to impress my own personality upon people, otherwise I shall become frustrated. And I do not believe in frustration. But if a critic is able to put over a perfectly worthless play, ah, you do perceive the difference. Therefore I shall make a hit out of... What's the name of your play, Ike?
No skin off your ass, said Ike.
I beg your pardon.
That's the title.
Oh, I see. Therefore I shall make a hit out of No Skin Off Your Ass.
Lois Cook laughed loudly.
You all make too damn much fuss about everything, said Gus Webb, lying flat, his hands entwined under his head.
Now, if you wish to consider your own case, Lance, Vogler went on, what satisfaction is there for a correspondent in reporting on world events? The public reads about all sorts of international crises, and you're lucky if they even notice your byline. But you're every bit as good as any general, admiral, or ambassador. You have a right to make people conscious of yourself. So you've done the wise thing. You've written a remarkable collection of bilge. Yes, bilge. But morally justified. A clever book. World catastrophes used as a backdrop for your own nasty little personality. How Lancelot Clokey got drunk at an international conference. What beauties slept with Lancelot Clokey during an invasion. How Lancelot Clokey got dysentery in a land of famine. Well, why not, Lance? It went over, didn't it? Ellsworth put it over, didn't he?
The public appreciates good human interest stuff, said Lancelot Clokey, looking angrily into his glass.
Oh, can the crap, Lance, cried Lois Cook. Who are you acting for here? You know damn well it wasn't any kind of a human interest, but plain Ellsworth, too.
I don't forget what I owe Ellsworth, said Clokey sullenly. Ellsworth's my best friend. Still, he couldn't have done it if he didn't have a good book to do it with.
8 months ago, Lancelot Clokey had stood with a manuscript in his hand before Ellsworth Tui, as Ike stood before Vogler now, not believing it when Tui told him that his book would top the bestseller list. But 200,000 copies sold had made it impossible for Clokey ever to recognize any truth again in any form.
"Well, he did it with the gallant gallstone," said Lois Cook, placidly. "And a worse piece of trash never was put down on paper. I ought to know. But he did it."
"And almost lost my job doing it," said Tui indifferently.
"What do you do with your liquor, Lois?" snapped Clokey. "Save it to take a bath in?"
"All right, blotter," said Lois Cook, rising lazily.
She shuffled across the room, picked somebody's unfinished drink off the floor, drank the remnant, walked out and came back with an assortment of expensive bottles. Clokey and Ike hurried to help themselves.
"I think you're unfair to Lance, Lois," said Tui. "Why shouldn't he write an autobiography?"
"Because his life wasn't worth living, let alone recording."
"Ah, but that is precisely why I made it a bestseller."
"You're telling me?"
"I like to tell someone."
There were many comfortable chairs around him, but Tui preferred to remain on the floor. He rolled over to his stomach, propping his torso upright on his elbows, and he lolled pleasurably, switching his weight from elbow to elbow, his legs spread out in a wide fork on the carpet. He seemed to enjoy unrestraint.
"I like to tell someone. Next month I'm pushing the autobiography of a small-town dentist who's really a remarkable person, because there's not a single remarkable day in his life nor sentence in his book. You'll like it, Lois."
Can you imagine a solid bromide undressing his soul as if it were a revelation?
The little people, said Ike tenderly. I love the little people. We must love the little people of this earth.
Save that for your next play, said Tui.
I can't, said Ike. It's in this one.
What's the big idea, Ellsworth? Snapped Clokey.
Why, it's simple, Lance.
When the fact that one is a total non-entity who's done nothing more outstanding than eating, sleeping, and chatting with neighbors becomes a fact worthy of pride, of announcement to the world, and of diligent study by millions of readers, the fact that one has built a cathedral becomes unrecordable and unannounceable. A matter of perspectives and relativity. The distance permissible between the extremes of any particular capacity is limited. The sound perception of an ant does not include thunder.
You talk like a decadent bourgeois, Ellsworth, said Gus Webb.
Pipe down, sweetie pie, said Tui without resentment.
It's all very wonderful, said Lois Cook, except that you're doing too well, Ellsworth. You'll run me out of business. Pretty soon, if I still want to be noticed, I'll have to write something that's actually good.
Not in this century, Lois, said Tui, and perhaps not in the next. It's later than you think.
But you haven't said...
Ike cried suddenly, worried.
What haven't I said?
You haven't said who's going to produce my play.
Leave that to me, said Jules Fogler.
I forgot to thank you, Ellsworth, said Ike solemnly. So now I thank you. There are lots of bum plays, but you picked mine. You and Mr. Fogler.
Your bumness is serviceable, Ike.
Well, that's something.
It's a great deal.
How? For instance.
Don't talk too much, Ellsworth, said Gus Webb. You've got a talking jag.
Shut your face, Cupid doll. I like to talk.
For instance, Ike?
Well, for instance, suppose I didn't like Ibsen.
Ibsen is good, said Ike.
Sure he's good. But suppose I didn't like him. Suppose I wanted to stop people from seeing his plays. It would do me no good whatever to tell them so. But if I sold them the idea that you're just as great as Ibsen, pretty soon they wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Jesus, can you?
It's only an example, Ike.
But it would be wonderful.
Yes. It would be wonderful. And then it wouldn't matter what they went to see at all. Then nothing would matter, neither the writers nor those for whom they wrote.
How's that, Ellsworth?
Look, Ike, there's no room in the theater for both Ibsen and you. You do understand that, don't you?
In a manner of speaking, yes.
Well, you do want me to make room for you, don't you?
All of this useless discussion has been covered before and much better, said Gus Webb. Shorter. I believe in functional economy.
Where's it covered, Gus? Asked Lois Cook.
Who had been nothing shall be all, sister. Gus is crude, but deep, said Ike. I like him.
Go to hell, said Gus.
Lois Cook's butler entered the room. He was a stately, elderly man, and he wore full-dress evening clothes. He announced Peter Keating.
Pete? Said Lois Cook, gaily.
Why, sure, shove him in, shove him right in.
Keating entered and stopped, startled, when he saw the gathering.
Oh. Hello, everybody, he said bleakly.
I didn't know you had company, Lois.
That's not company. Come in, Peter, sit down, grab yourself a drink. You know everybody.
Hello, Ellsworth, said Keating, his eyes resting on Tui for support. Tui waved his hand, scrambled to his feet, and settled down in an armchair, crossing his legs gracefully. Everybody in the room adjusted himself automatically to a sudden control, to sit straighter, to bring knees together, to pull in a relaxed mouth. Only Gus Webb remained stretched as before. Keating looked cool and handsome, bringing into the unventilated room the freshness of a walk through cold streets. But he was pale, and his movements were slow, tired.
"Sorry if I intrude, Lois," he said. "Had nothing to do and felt so damn lonely, thought I'd drop in."
He slurred over the word lonely, throwing it away with a self-deprecatory smile. "Damn tired of Neil Dumont and the bunch. Wanted more uplifting company. Sort of spiritual food, huh?"
I'm a genius, said Ike. I'll have a play on Broadway. Me and Ibsen. Ellsworth said so.
Ike has just read his new play to us, said Tui. A magnificent piece of work.
You'll love it, Peter, said Lancelot Cloakie.
It's really great.
It is a masterpiece, said Jules Fogler. I hope you will prove yourself worthy of it, Peter. It is the kind of play that depends upon what the members of the audience are capable of bringing with them into the theater. If you are one of those literal-minded people with a dry soul and a limited imagination, it is not for you. But if you are a real human being, with a big, big heart full of laughter, who has preserved the uncorrupted capacity of his childhood for pure emotion, you will find it an unforgettable experience.
Except as ye become as little children, ye shall not enter the kingdom of heaven, said Ellsworth Tui.
Thanks, Ellsworth, said Jules Fogler. That will be the lead of my review.
Keating looked at Ike, at the others, his eyes eager. They all seemed remote and pure, far above him in the safety of their knowledge, but their faces had hints of smiling warmth, a benevolent invitation extended downward. Keating drank the sense of their greatness, the spiritual food he sought in coming here, and felt himself rising through them. They saw their greatness made real by him. A circuit was established in the room, and the circle closed. Everybody was conscious of that, except Peter Keating. Ellsworth Tui came out in support of the cause of modern architecture. In the past 10 years, while most of the new residences continued to be built as faithful historical copies, the principles of Henry Cameron had won the field of commercial structures, the factories, the office buildings, the skyscrapers. It was a pale, distorted victory, a reluctant compromise that consisted of omitting columns and pediments, allowing a few stretches of wall to remain naked, apologizing for a shape, good through accident, by finishing it off with an edge of simplified Grecian volutes. Many stole Cameron's forms. Few understood his thinking. The sole part of his argument, irresistible to the owners of new structures, was financial economy. He won to that extent. In the countries of Europe, most prominently in Germany, a new school of building had been growing for a long time. It consisted of putting up four walls and a flat top over them with a few openings. This was called New Architecture. The freedom from arbitrary rules, for which Cameron had fought, the freedom that imposed a great new responsibility on the creative builder, became a mere elimination of all effort, even the effort of mastering historical styles. It became a rigid set of new rules, the discipline of conscious incompetence, creative poverty made into a system, mediocrity boastfully confessed.
A building creates its own beauty, and its ornament is derived from the rules of its theme and its structure, Cameron had said.
A building needs no beauty, no ornament, and no theme, said the new architects. It was safe to say it. Cameron and a few men had broken the path and paved it with their lives. Other men, of whom there were greater numbers, the men who had been safe in copying the Parthenon, saw the danger and found a way to security. To walk Cameron's path and make it lead them to a new Parthenon, an easier Parthenon, in the shape of a packing crate of glass and concrete. The palm tree had broken through. The fungus came to feed on it, to deform it, to hide, to pull it back into the common jungle. The jungle found its words. In one small voice, subtitled, I Swim with the Current, Ellsworth Tui wrote, We have hesitated for a long time to acknowledge the powerful phenomenon known as modern architecture. Such caution is requisite in anyone who stands in the position of mentor to the public taste. Too often, isolated manifestations of anomaly can be mistaken for a broad popular movement, and one should be careful not to ascribe to them a significance they do not deserve. But modern architecture has stood the test of time, has answered a demand of the masses, and we are glad to salute it. It is not amiss to offer a measure of recognition to the pioneers of this movement, such as the late Henry Cameron. Premonitory echoes of the new grandeur can be found in some of his work, but like all pioneers, he was still bound by the inherited prejudices of the past, by the sentimentality of the middle class from which he came. He succumbed to the superstition of beauty and ornament, even though the ornament was of his own devising, and, consequently, inferior to that of established historical forms. It remained for the power of a broad collective movement to bring modern architecture to its full and true expression. Now it can be seen, growing throughout the world, not as a chaos of individual fancies, but as a cohesive, organized discipline, which makes severe demands upon the artist, among them the demand to subordinate himself to the collective nature of his craft. The rules of this new architecture have been formulated by the vast process of popular creation. They are as strict as the rules of classicism. They demand unadorned simplicity, like the honesty of the unspoiled common man. Just as in the passing age of international bankers, every building had to have an ostentatious cornice, so now the coming age ordains that every building have a flat roof. Just as the imperialist era required a Roman portico on every house, so the era of humanity requires that every house have corner windows, symbol of the sunshine distributed equally to all. The discriminating will see the social significance eloquent in the forms of this new architecture. Under the old system of exploitation, the most useful social elements, the workers, were never permitted to realize their importance. Their practical functions were kept hidden and disguised. Thus, a master had his servants dressed up in fancy gold-braided livery. This was reflected in the architecture of the period. The functional elements of a building, its doors, windows, stairways, were hidden under the scrolls of pointless ornamentation, but in a modern building, it is precisely these useful elements, symbols of toil, that come starkly in the open. Do we not hear in this the voice of a new world, where the worker shall come into his own? As the best example of modern architecture in America, we call to your attention the new plant of the Bassett Brush Company, soon to be completed. It is a small building, but in its modest proportion, it embodies all the grim simplicity of the new discipline and presents an invigorating example of the grandeur of the little. It was designed by Augustus Webb, a young architect of great promise. Meeting Toohey a few days later, Peter Keating asked, disturbed, "Say, Ellsworth, did you mean it?"
"What?"
"About modern architecture?"
"Of course I meant it. How did you like my little piece?"
"Oh, I thought it was very beautiful, very convincing. But say, Ellsworth, why did you pick Gus Webb? After all, I've done some modernistic things in the last few years. The Palmer Building was quite bare, and the Mowry Building was nothing but roof and windows, and the Shelton Warehouse was—"
"Now, Peter, don't be a hog. I've done pretty well by you, haven't I? Let me give somebody else a boost once in a while."
At a luncheon, where he had to speak on architecture, Peter Keating stated, "In reviewing my career to date, I came to the conclusion that I have worked on a true principle, the principle that constant change is a necessity of life. Since buildings are an indispensable part of life, it follows that architecture must change constantly. I have never developed any architectural prejudices for myself, but insisted on keeping my mind open to all the voices of the times. The fanatics who went around preaching that all structures must be modern were just as narrow-minded as the hidebound conservatives who demanded that we employ nothing but historical styles. I do not apologize for those of my buildings which were designed in the classical tradition. They were an answer to the need of their era. Neither do I apologize for the buildings which I designed in the modern style. They represent the coming better world. It is my opinion that in the humble realization of this principle lies the reward and the joy of being an architect." There was gratifying publicity, and many flattering comments of envy in professional circles, when the news of Peter Keating's selection to build Stone Ridge was made public. He tried to recapture his old pleasure in such manifestations. He failed. He still felt something that resembled gladness, but it was faded and thin. The effort of designing Stone Ridge seemed a load too vast to lift. He did not mind the circumstances through which he had obtained it. That, too, had become pale and weightless in his mind, accepted and almost forgotten. He simply could not face the task of designing the great number of houses that Stone Ridge required. He felt very tired. He felt tired when he awakened in the morning, and he found himself waiting all day for the time when he would be able to go back to bed. He turned Stone Ridge over to Neil Dumont and Bennett.
"Go ahead," he said wearily.
"Do what you want."
"What style, Pete?"
Dumont asked.
"Oh, make it some sort of period. The small homeowners won't go for it otherwise, but trim it down a little for the press comments. Give it historical touches and a modern feeling. Any way you wish, I don't care."
Dumont and Bennett went ahead. Keating changed a few roof lines on their sketches, a few windows. The preliminary drawings were approved by Winand's office. Keating did not know whether Winand had approved in person. He did not see Winand again. Dominique had been away a month when Guy Francon announced his retirement. Keating had told him about the divorce, offering no explanation. Francon had taken the news calmly. He had said,
"I expected it. It's all right, Peter. It's probably not your fault, nor hers."
He had not mentioned it since. Now he gave no explanation of his retirement, only,
"I told you it was coming long ago. I'm tired. Good luck, Peter."
The responsibility of the firm on his lonely shoulders, and the prospect of his solitary name on the office door, left Keating uneasy. He needed a partner. He chose Neil Dumont. Neil had grace and distinction. He was another Lucius Hire. The firm became Peter Keating and Cornelius Dumont. Some sort of drunken celebration of the event was held by a few friends, but Keating did not attend it. He had promised to attend, but he forgot about it, went for a solitary weekend in the snowbound country, and did not remember the celebration until the morning after it was held, when he was walking alone down a frozen country road. Stone Ridge was the last contract signed by the firm of Francon and Keating. Chapter 7. When Dominique stepped off the train in New York, Winand was there to meet her. She had not written to him nor heard from him during the weeks of her residence in Reno. She had notified no one of her return. But his figure standing on the platform, standing calmly with an air of finality, told her that he had kept in touch with her lawyers, had followed every step of the divorce proceedings, had known the date when the decree was granted, the hour when she took the train, and the number of her compartment. He did not move forward when he saw her. It was she who walked to him, because she knew that he wanted to see her walking, if only the short space between them. She did not smile, but her face had the lovely serenity that can become a smile without transition.
"Hello, Gail."
"Hello, Dominique."
She had not thought of him in his absence, not sharply, not with a personal feeling of his reality, but now she felt an immediate recognition, a sense of reunion with someone known and needed. He said,
"Give me your baggage checks. I'll have it attended to later. My car is outside."
She handed him the checks, and he slipped them into his pocket. They knew they must turn and walk up the platform to the exit, but the decisions both had made in advance broke down in the same instant, because they did not turn, but remained standing, looking at each other. He made the first effort to correct the breach. He smiled lightly.
"If I had the right to say it, I'd say that I couldn't have endured the waiting had I known that you'd look as you do. But since I have no such right, I'm not going to say it."
She laughed. "All right, Gail,